We're back with Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. How do we learn who we are or who we aren't? How big a role does our family play in who we become? And how much can we successfully rewrite our own histories? The possibility of reinvention lies at the heart of Rebecca Mackay's newest novel, The 100-Year House. Part mystery, part family drama, part ghost story, and wholly engaging and entertaining, The 100-Year House is set in a fictional house in the Midwest that once housed an artist colony, and which still has many, many secrets a century later. The novel also tells its stories in reverse, starting from the year 2000 and moving backward in sections to the beginning in 1900. The reader ends up knowing the full story, even as none of the characters do. Rebecca Mackay lives in Chicago, and she'll appear at Boswell Book Company tonight to read from and to discuss The 100-Year House. But she's with us in the studio now. Rebecca, welcome back to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
The 100-Year House, I have to say, right up front, I loved it.
Oh, thanks.
I enjoyed it thoroughly. And I want to actually start at the end, and it's actually not even part of the book. It's part of the acknowledgments, where you say that the book started out as a story about male anorexia, and you don't know what happened after that.
Yeah, just so that we don't get accused of false advertising,
right.
There's no male anorexia
female
anorexia anywhere in the book. Yeah, that's what it was. About 10 years back, I started a short story that was largely about these two couples that had moved in together in a coach house, a small sort of chauffeur's house on a large estate. And the man of one of the couples was anorexic, and the man in the other couple was the only one who noticed and was trying to get everyone to realize what was going on. It did not work as a short story, but what I loved about the setup and why I came back to it then a few years later was this idea of the smaller house on a large estate. How 100 years ago, those little places were built, especially in the Midwest, get them a lot down in Chicago where I am, some of the suburbs up in Milwaukee here, you have some too. They were built as houses for chauffeurs, servants. Now that's not who lives in it at all. No one has a chauffeur anymore. And even if you're a billionaire, it's in-laws now. You rent it out to people. And I like the idea of that changing relationship over time between the people in the little house and the people in the big house. And I like the characters I had, but yeah, the anorexia thread eventually got cut out of the novel.
Well, and yes, you have the coach house, you have the big estate, you have the changing relationships of people. The other thing that I found very interesting is the claustrophobia.
Yeah.
The fact that all of these people were mushed together, in this case, reluctantly.
Right. You have this one huge mansion where we meet Z. She's one of the main characters in the first section of the book in 1999. And it's her mother who's living in this big house. Her mother offers her and her husband the coach house, but then really quickly moves another couple in there too without ever thinking to offer them space in the big house. That would never occur to her, right? And they're crammed together. They don't know each other very well. And they're moved into this tiny space. They're sharing a kitchen. They're sharing a living space. And of course, weird things happen. It's a weird house anyway. There are weird vibes there. People are unhappy. There's weird energy. But even in addition to that, just the sexual politics of two couples living in close proximity. A couple of them are out of work. They're hanging around the house together all day. They're not the two that are married to each other.
Of course.
Things happen.
Right. And there's also one is an artist, mm-hmm. and this house had been an artist colony.
Right.
And that's part of the history, which we learn right away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not a secret.
Right. We know we're going to be moving backwards in time over the course of this book. We start in 1999, then we go back to the 50s, then we go back to the 20s, when this estate was an artist colony in full swing, the kind of place where artists, writers, musicians would come and stay for a couple weeks, a couple months, and do their work. And these places are still around. There are some in the Midwest. But what's interesting to one of the characters in 1999, Z's husband, Doug, he's been trying since graduate school to write a book about this poet, Edwin Parfitt. And he knows that Edwin Parfitt once stayed at the colony. And he almost feels like as if by being so close to where Edwin Parfitt stayed, somehow magically that's going to help him write this, which of course is ridiculous until it's not.
When you were
playing with these two couples, and it turned in, you know, the anorexia thread went away and it turned into the 100-year house. Did the idea of moving backward in time come with it, or was that something you always had in mind before you even started?
It came a little later, actually. So I had this idea of these two couples in this coach house, the big estate, maybe the idea that this house had been an artist's colony, the sense of some mystery in the background. And I realized that was going to be a novel. It wasn't a short story. And I started writing that as a novel. But I was going to have to leave a lot of things unanswered. They were going to bring up these mysteries of the past, wonder about them, try to find the files of the colony. And the ultimate message of the book was kind of going to be, well, we'll never know. And how unsatisfying is that? That real life is like that. And real life isn't always fun that way. I wanted to go down the rabbit hole. And I realized one day, I was brushing my teeth. I realized I could actually take them back in time. I could go back to the 50s when something kind of violent and cataclysmic happened. I could go back to the 20s when it was a colony. And at the very end, I could even go back to 1900 when the estate was being built. And that scared the hell out of me. I realized, you know, I was cutting out a lot more work for myself.
Oh, okay.
You know, I was like, oh, I'm almost done. I have the whole thing plotted out. And then I'm standing brushing my teeth going, wait, I could do this. And it's going to take me 3 more years to do it, but it was worth it.
I love the idea of going backward. The thing that kind of was melancholy for me is that knowing that the characters in that first section aren't ever going to know what I knew at the end of the book.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. In a lot of ways, you know, it's a story that is in some ways a ghost story and in some ways not. No ghost is going to pop out at you, but there's always the question of ghosts, who's haunting the place. And one of the answers, I think, to that question is that we are the ghosts, the readers. We are the ones who have witnessed all of this history. We are the only ones who can put it together. And we're uniquely unable to convey that information to the people who need to know it. And that's the position a ghost is in. So, you know, there are other answers to that ghost story mystery, too, of who's haunting the house, who's pulling these people around. But one of the answers is us.
That's fascinating. I hadn't thought of it that way before. But, yeah, we can't tell them. We can't go back to the beginning of the book and say, wait.
Right.
I know what's happening.
And how badly do we want to? And that's what we imagine ghosts are doing, too, right? They have something they want to tell us. They know stuff we don't know. They've seen it all, and they can't tell us.
Art plays a huge role here, too, almost as important a role as the human characters. What art is, what we need to make it, what it needs in order to flourish. And, of course, this is an artist colony, but it's a reluctant one.
Yeah. You know, when we start in 1999, we have Doug, who's trying to write about a poet. And we have Miriam, the wife in this other couple, who is herself an artist. She's making collage out of sort of detritus, these weird mosaics. And Miriam has that energy, that same energy that the artist did back in 1929. And maybe that's the reason that things start to happen then in the house. It's the first time the house has really had an artist in it since the colony was shut down and turned back into a private residence. And you know, people don't understand her art. They don't understand what she's doing. People don't even understand why Doug would be writing about a poet. People keep thinking he is a poet. So there's sort of this conflict between the artists and what they want to do and the people who've earned the money that have made this kind of place possible, often not the same people.
Usually not the same people.
Usually not. Yeah. Usually not. Sometimes, you know, occasionally it is. And, yeah, when we go back to the 20s, we get this group of artists fighting for the colony's survival. The house has been turned into an artist's colony, but the DeVores, the family who owns the estate, still, even though it's a colony, are threatening to shut them down. And they're doing anything they can to keep it open. So it's very much a justification of art that's going on. They're fighting for the right and the need to produce their art, to show this person, this representative of the DeVore family who's come to shut them down, why it should stay open. And when that fails, they resort to some kind of fun foul play instead,
yes.
Actually.
Yes. And obviously, things happen. I don't want to, again, give anything away. Lots of stuff happens. Why do you think, as a writer, I mean, you're an artist yourself, why is it so important to have a place like Laurel Field, which is the name of this fictitious artist colony?
Right. You know, for one thing, you know, artist colonies still exist, and I've stayed at 3 of them in the past few years. It's become especially important to me after I had kids. These colonies have in some ways leveled the playing field for female artists, for artists who are under hard economic times, who've maybe lost studio space. And honestly, a lot of it is for women or for men at this point who normally work from home with kids around. And to be able to get away for 2 weeks to get something done is huge. So and you think I know a lot of artists who lost studio space after Hurricane Sandy in New York. And just to have a place to go and regroup, they'd lost years worth of artwork. Then they were able to move into a place like Yaddo and McDowell and have a dry studio space for one thing that wasn't filled with mold, but to just start again, to have 2 months to work uninterrupted, funded. Their meals are taken care of. So it can be the tipping point, I think, into success for a lot of artists. And it can also be a place that rescues you from disaster. And for those of us who maybe aren't, quite as desperate, it can just be a place where you can get away from daily life, from obligations, from children and work. But it's also the permission to work. It's the uninterrupted nature of it. And then it's the community.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, it seems to me that certainly in the book, but I would imagine in real artist colonies as well, part of it is that you come together at night.
Exactly.
And either talk about your work or don't talk about your work or listen to somebody else talk about theirs or just be together.
That's it. You have dinner together every night. So sometimes it's just a silly conversation, but very often you're hearing about someone's frustrations, about what someone's working on, their next project. Collaborations come about in really interesting ways. Sometimes, you know, you'll get two musicians who never would have collaborated. Like you'll get a baritone singer, composer, and a clarinetist. And they're sitting there going, yeah, let's do something together. And something crazy comes out of it. You also get to hear each other read or perform if those people want to share their work. And very often I've been at places where artists have opened up their studios and let us walk through. There was one artist who, if you read this book, you'll recognize his influence on it. When I was working on this, I was staying at Yaddo in upstate New York, and there was an artist there who smashed china every day. And it had to do with recording it and making it into music. It was absolutely beautiful. But every day I'd walk past him smashing teacups out on the tennis court, and then he'd be sweeping them up afterwards. So either he was breaking china or he was sweeping it up. That was already a theme going on, broken things, repaired things, people making things, making these mosaics in my book. But when I saw that, I felt like I had to use it more. It was an injection into the book of that idea, that shattering and reimaging, yeah.
And also sweeping up.
Yes.
There's some of that that's going on in here, too.
Very much.
There are various people who are left to sweep up the pieces.
Oh, absolutely. It's in many ways, thematically, it's a book about reinvention, about people whose lives have been shattered or left behind in various ways. And there are characters who choose suicide in this book, who leave their lives behind in a very dramatic, very unhappy way. But there are also characters who abandon their lives in equal measure, but absolutely rebuild them as someone else or in a different place. The colony that's been disbanded comes back together in 1999. It gets reformed. Towards the end of the book, there's a mention of an artist who's not really a major character, but who would break pottery and then glue it back together so that it would be, you know, fractured but whole. And that's really a sort of an analog for a lot of what's going on in terms of people's souls, I think, in the book.
Well, also, you know, if you talk to doctors, if like you break a leg, the bone where it knits together is actually stronger.
Right.
And so I think there's some of that, too, that all of these pieces get knitted back together in possibly different shapes, but I think it's stronger in the end.
Right. These are lives that people have chosen. They're new marriages, in one case, that people have chosen maybe under better circumstances than the happenstance sort of the first marriage. New identities that are very carefully crafted. So in a way, part of the message of the book is that the self that you choose or that you rebuild out of the ashes or out of the shards is better and stronger than what you were simply given to begin with.
How much of the idea of this Midwestern artist colony came from your own experience of growing up here and being on the North Shore and seeing, you know, houses and the architecture like this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. All of it. You know, it's set north of Chicago, somewhere between Milwaukee and Chicago. And although I don't mention it by name in the book, I think most people familiar with the area would recognize it as Lake Forest, Illinois, which is still near where I live. I always qualify that by telling people I don't live in a mansion. you know, I drive past these estates when I'm doing errands, and I grew up driving past them and had friends sometimes who lived in them or babysat in them, even as I was solidly middle class as a child. So I've always had this fascination with these estates. And there is an artist colony in Lake Forest, Ragdale, which has a very different history from Laurel Field. It wasn't a colony until the 1980s. So really inverse chronology to what Laurel Field has. But I think anyone familiar with Ragdale would both recognize it and recognize that it's not really about Ragdale. But this gorgeous old house, these amazing grounds, sculpture everywhere. Sylvia Shaw Judson, who's the sculptor who made the Bird Girl statue that a lot of people know from the cover of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, it was her house. And her sculptures are still there. There's a copy of Bird Girl there, which is the most haunting statue. And you know, I couldn't resist putting female sculptors into the 1929 section of the book. And it's very much a nod to her. And not only was it influenced by my life on the North Shore, but I think this architectural setup of the grand house and then the coach house is in some ways a Midwestern phenomenon. I know that it exists elsewhere, but what you had in the Midwest and on the North Shore in particular was all of these estates built right around the turn of the 20th century. In response to the Haymarket riots in Chicago, all of these wealthy millionaires leaving the city, they were terrified of these mobs attacking capitalists, moving up to the suburbs and building these huge walled estates with all this money from the Industrial Revolution. And because they were built around the advent of the automobile and these people were wealthy, they had cars, they would have this coach house or carriage house for their cars and their chauffeur. Now, 100 years later, we still have them. And what are you going to do with that?
Now, you spent a year here, right, after school?
I did, yeah. When I graduated from college, I lived in St. Francis. And I loved it. And I was doing some teacher training work up there. And it was in this old, I hope this building is still there, but this old converted monastery right across from the lake that they were using for all different kinds of nonprofits. And one of them was this teacher training. And I would just wander through these hallways. And I loved the history of it. That was the kind of place that I could, you know, could write another novel just about that one building.
Well, maybe that's next.
Yeah. St. Francis Monastery.
There you go. Well, I'm hoping, before you get to that book, I'm hoping that we will hear something from 100 Year House. Where are we and can you set it up, please?
I will. So if you've heard the rest of the interview, you should be in pretty good shape. We're in 1999 and we're in the coach house. We're in the place where Z and Doug, the original couple, have been living. Doug's the one trying to write about this poet, Edwin Parfitt, who stayed at Laurel Field. Miriam and Case are the other couple who've moved in, and Miriam is the mosaic artist, and she's kind of nutty. And at this point, Doug doesn't really know what's going on with her, and he's found her on the sun porch where she works, and she's sobbing because she's just found out that John F. Kennedy Jr. has died. And she's taking it a little too personally for something that it was tragic but didn't affect her in real life. And what they're talking about here at the beginning is that Bruce, who lives in the big house with Z's mother, Gracie, is preparing sort of maniacally for Y2K. He really feels like the apocalypse is coming. And Doug has just seen how he has been making the housekeeper buy bags and bags of table salt to store along with all these other canned goods. So I'll start reading there. "You must think I'm crazy," she said. "No, no, not at all. It's a sad event. That's horrible, that whole family. There was the one who just died on the skis, right? And now this, and he was the best one." She sniffed wetly. He wanted to leave, but she'd be hurt. So he said, "Did you see what Bruce is making Sophia do?" And told her about the salt for the end of the world. "Oh, he asked us to store the canned goods. Did you know that? He goes, 'You have all that room on the ground floor. How about we fill you up?' He's worried about mice in the basement at the big house." "Mice that bite through cans?" She smiled a little, which was a relief. Apparently. I mean, I guess there's pasta boxes and stuff, and their pantries are packed, and he said the attic is full of old furniture and file cabinets Gracie won't throw out. He laughed, trying to make her laugh. What files could Gracie need? I've never seen that woman touch a piece of paper that wasn't a note to the staff. Maybe they're from that arts camp. He said the furniture was. He said there were at least 20 mattresses up there and headboards and dressers. Really? Doug had been leaning against the doorframe, but now he sat on the floor among the heaps of cloth and shredded magazines. The vague promise of some artifact of Edwin Parfitt's had hit Doug in the solar plexus, and he felt like a man meeting his former lover on the street, someone he believed he'd forgotten, but whose overwhelming effect indicated otherwise. Christ, he said. Listen, you know, first of all, it wasn't an arts camp. It was a major arts colony. Okay, so no, a minor one, but extremely important, at least in the 20s. I mean, you're an artist. Charles DeMuth, Grant Wood, think what could be up there. What do you mean, Charles DeMuth? He stayed here? He stayed here? I adore him. I mean, his stuff's in the attic. She looked as if he'd told her JFK Jr. had just swum to shore, shaken but still dreamy. Potentially, he added. But didn't artists do that? They'd leave paintings as payment? She sunk her head again. I don't know, Doug. This isn't what it sounded like with Bruce. He just said there were disgusting file cabinets and the furniture. If there were anything valuable, he'd know. But if someone like DeMuth just doodled on an envelope, Bruce would have no idea what that even was. Doug wasn't sure why he was trying to get Miriam interested, since he didn't want her messing this up for him. Maybe he was just irrationally insulted that she wasn't as excited as he was. He refrained from mentioning Parfitt. If she'd been paying any attention that night at the big house, she'd have heard him say Parfitt stayed there. But he left her to her collages and her weeping and asked her not to say anything about the files. More secrets, she said. He couldn't read her tone. What fun.
Indeed, what fun. Rebecca Mackay, thank you so much for stopping by and reading from The 100-Year House.
Absolutely, thank you.
Rebecca Mackay reading from her newest novel, The 100-Year House. It's published by Viking. Mackay lives in Chicago, and she'll appear at Boswell Book Company tonight. There is a link to more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break and then return with an in-studio performance and conversation with Milwaukee singer-songwriter Joe Huber. You're listening to Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.